This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Soulmarked, Book 3 of the Fatemarked Epic. Written by David Estes. Performed by Derek Perkins. The story so far. The Hundred Years' War has stretched over a century, ravaging the nations of the Four Kingdoms. Before the war began, a prophecy was made by a woman now known as the Western Oracle. The prophecy, which promised the coming of the Fatemarked, who would bring peace to the lands, has been forgotten by many, while others believe it to be naught but a legend. Still, the truth of the ancient words has begun to come to pass, as there are those being born with strange markings that grant the bearers unusual powers. In some lands, the marked are revered, in others hated, even put to death. One of the Fatemarked, the King's Bane, has his own prophecy, to bring death to 8 rulers across the 4 kingdoms, which will usher in a time of peace. His work has already begun. 3 rulers have been killed in swift succession. King Wulfric Geric, known as the Dread King of the North, King Gil Loren of the West, and King Oran Ironclad, the Juggernaut of the East, have all fallen. But Bane's task is far from finished, and now he plans to turn his attention to the South. Little is known of what has been transpiring in the southern empires of Calip and Fanes, except that the 2 nations have been embroiled in a civil war caused by the marriage dissolution of the 2 main sovereigns, Empress Sun Sands and Emperor Vin Hosa. In the kingdoms, however, time has marched ever onwards. To the west. With the death of King Gil Loren at the hand of the King's Bane, his eldest nephew, Jove Loren, attempts to usurp the throne from the true heir, Princess Rhea Loren. To accomplish this, Rhea is charged by the Furia with breaking her vow of purity with a common thief known as Grease Jolly, an alias for his true name, Grey Aris. As punishment, a W for whore is carved on her face, leaving permanent scars. In her mind, her greatest attribute, her beauty, has been stripped from her, leaving her with nothing left but revenge. When her horror and sadness turn to white-hot anger, she murders her cousin Jove and reclaims her crown, vowing next to win the war and defeat her enemies on all sides. Meanwhile, Grey Aris's sister, Shay Aris, who is fate-marked, is abducted by the Furia and taken south to a chain of islands called the Dead Isles, which are rumored to be haunted. Grey, charged with thievery, has his hand cut off as punishment, but manages to escape Night's End with some help from Rhea. Grey follows the Furia, eventually hiring onto a ship the Jewel, which is headed south. His goal? Find his sister and rescue her. To the north. After Bane murders the Dread King, the crown shifts to Archer Geric. However, before he can claim it, his uncle, Lord Griswold, swoops in, accusing he and his mother, Sabria Loren, of conspiring to kill the king. The eldest of the king's heirs, Anise, feels powerless as she watches the execution of her mother. When Archer is brought to be executed, however, the executioner suddenly makes himself known as a famous warrior known as the Armored Knight. They escape through the sewers along with another knight, Sir Dietrich. While they travel to the southern part of the realm, Anise realizes she has turned 18 and now has the primary claim on the throne. She refuses to tell her brother, though she confides in the Armored Knight, who turns out to be her long-lost friend from childhood, Terin Shiri, believed to be dead, but now cursed by the witch's potion that saved his life. They also meet up with their eccentric aunt, Lady Zelda, who reveals that the King's Bane is actually their younger brother, who was smuggled from the north immediately after birth. When the Easterners attack Raiders Pass, Archer is knocked unconscious by the King's Bane, his own brother, who turns up to try to kill Anise, who is now the lawful queen of the north. However, Sir Dietrich manages to fight Bane off, showcasing his uncanny skills with the blade. Bane, exhausted from the ordeal, vanishes. Anise and the others seize victory from the east, killing King Ironclad and others. Now, with Anise having declared herself the true queen, and with Archer comatose, the Gerics and their allies are marching north toward Castle Hill to reclaim the throne from the usurper, Lord Griswold. To the east. When a young man named Roan, who grew up in Calypso, contracts the plague from a mysterious beggar on the street, he's sent to quarantine on an island called Dragon's Breath. There he reveals his own fate mark, called the Life Mark, which allows him to heal himself and escape the island, which is guarded by two-headed dragons. Fateful currents pull him to the east, where a chance meeting makes him the prisoner of Prince Gareth Ironclad, who immediately brings him to Ironwood and the eastern capital of Feria, the Iron City, where humans live in harmony with the Aurians, a mystical people who can channel the ore that lies beneath the forest. With the help of one of the Aurians, a fate-marked named Gwendolyn Storm, King Ironclad swiftly learns of Roan's marking and forces him into helping their armies as they march on Raiders Pass to enact revenge on the North for the killing of the Queen. Roan reluctantly agrees, and soon learns that the East has another of the fate-marked, a mighty warrior named Bjorn Stonesledge, the Iron-marked. Roan also discovers that, as the firstborn son, Gareth is the Shield, which means his life is forfeit, to be given to protect the second-born son, Guy, the true heir to the Eastern Throne. Along the way, Roan begins to grow close to both Gwen and Gareth. At Raiders Pass, the North defeats them, killing King Ironclad, Prince Guy Ironclad, and injuring Bjorn Stonesledge. Gareth Ironclad is nearly killed by the King's Bane as he tries to protect Guy, but Roan saves him by using his life mark. In the aftermath of defeat, Gwendolyn Storm realizes who Roan really is, Roan Loren, Prince of the West and true heir to the Western Kingdom. She helps him escape, and together they slip away, crossing the border between nations and into the Tangle, the largest western forest, known to be almost impassable. In Truthmarked, to the north. While her brother Archer continues his slumber, Queen Anise Garrick leads her forces against Castle Hill. Before they reach their destination, they encounter a knight, Sir Metz, who has just come from the castle. He brings tidings of an army of monsters, created from men by an elixir contrived by Lord Griswold's potion master, Darkspell. Though the news shakes Anise, she refuses to back down from the fight. During the battle, the monsters are killed one by one, but not without a heavy toll. Anise loses almost her entire army, including Lady Zelda's husband, Sir Craig. However, they do make one ally during the bloodbath, Sir Jonius, in the form of a monstrous bear who, by sheer will of heart, manages to maintain control and switches sides, helping them achieve victory, killing the Ice Lord and Lord Griswold, both of whom are monsters themselves. Taryn Sheeri, the armored knight, also survives, but is overcome by his bloodlust. Fearing he might be capable of harming Anise, he sneaks away while she is held captive by her queenly duties. With her army annihilated and having learned that her uncle had lost the rest of the northern forces in the Bay of Bounty, Anise knows the north is ripe for invasion. Sir Jonius comes forward with a map only recently discovered. The map shows the location of an ancient group of mighty warriors known as the Sleeping Knights, who, as legend tells, will awaken in the North's time of need. Anise immediately begins making plans to lead a small expedition into the hinterlands to locate these knights, who may be the North's only hope. To the west. Queen Rhea Loren, much to the chagrin of her cousin and adviser Ennis Loren, enlists the help of a man known as the Summoner, long considered to be a practitioner of old magic forbidden by their deity, Roth. When the Northern Armada sails out from Blackstone, Rhea commands him to summon an ancient monster of the deep called Rathos. He does, and is killed a moment later, but not before Rathos obliterates the Northern ships, leaving none alive. During the melee, Ennis disobeys a direct command from his sovereign, saving Rhea rather than the summoner. With no other choice, Rhea charges Ennis with treason and plans his execution. In the end, however, her conscience makes a reappearance and she fakes his death, giving him a disguise and false name in her guard. Meanwhile, in the Tangle, Roan and Gwen struggle to navigate through the insufferable forest. Soon they are joined by Gareth Ironclad, who tracks them after fleeing the east as the failed Shield. Together, they overcome an unexpected attack by a wood nymph queen, who tries to enslave Roan and Gareth. Gwen saves them with help from a half-man, half-bear, who calls himself Bear Blackboots, and then disappears. Eventually they reach Night's End, where Roan decides to take a risk and reveal himself to his sister. Rhea swiftly betrays him, imprisoning Gwen and Gareth. Gareth tries to commit suicide so he can't be ransomed to the east, but Roan saves his life yet again. When Roan and Rhea uncover information that implies either the Western Oracle or her son might still be alive, she forces him to go south, to the Calypsian city of Citadel, to bring them back in chains. If he doesn't, she promises to kill Gwendolyn Storm. To the south. In Calypso, the beggar who infected Roan allows himself to be captured by the Empress, Sun Sands, but is then pushed into her by Bane, who shows up unexpectedly. She dies of the plague, Bane's fourth kill under the prophecy. The Calypsian throne is fought for by two of her daughters, Raven and Fire, but it is Fire, one of the Fate-marked, who emerges with the Empire. She immediately plans a mission to Fane's to attack the Southron gates, taking most of her elite warriors, the Guanero, led by Goggin. They cross the desert, stopping only in the oasis of Kesh, where Fire is nearly assassinated. From there they ford the spear, marching on the gates, managing to melt two of the four massive doors before Phoenician forces repel them. Fire is killed, her body exploding in a firestorm that incinerates the remaining enemies and lights the tangle far to the north on fire. The unburning tree finally burns to ash. Raven Sands becomes Empress without challenge from her youngest sister, Whisper, who is heartbroken by the death of her mother and sister. Raven learns it was the Easterners that plotted to assassinate Fire at Kesh, and she immediately begins considering revenge. In Fane's, Jai Jaru is a slave master bearing the Justice Mark. He is intent on freeing his slaves in Garadia Mine and helping them escape across the border. His opportunity comes when the mine is attacked by a group of rebels known as the Black Tears. They are led by Sonika Vade, although it is another of them, Shanti Parthena Lord, who Jai becomes closest with. Together, they lead 5,000 slaves across the arid wasteland, barely surviving an attack from a feared Red Pison, before reaching the Southron gates at the same moment as the attack by the Calypsians. At the same moment, the beggar, who has been befriended by Bane, appears before Jai. Bane has charged him with spreading the plague in Fane's to eradicate any warmongers. However, the beggar refuses, remembering who he once was, a boy named Chavos. Instead, he stabs himself in the gut, though Bane manages to save him. In the confusion, Jai, the Black Tears, and the surviving slaves breach the wall and emerge into Western territory, free at last. However, in a horrifying twist of fate, one of the slaves, an ex-master named Axa, betrays them with a magic mirror, which allows the Emperor, Vinhosa, who bears the slave mark, to re-enslave them all. They are brought back to Garadia, where Jai, along with most of the Black Tears, is now a slave in the very mine he once controlled. Shanti, however, is taken to Fenir to slave away in the palace. Jai is in despair until Bane kills Emperor Hosa, thus releasing every slave across Fane's from his magic. And now, the story continues. Part 1. Lisbeth, Anise, Taryn, Rhea, Gwen, Gareth, Ennis, Kristoff, Zelda. Their fates are movable, changeable. None can foresee that which is as fluid as the forever shifting rivers of time. The Western Oracle. 1. The Hinterlands, circa 532. Lisbeth Lorne. She arrived in the midst of a storm, in the deepest throes of night. Born of thunder and lightning and howling wind and needles of sleet, she was a spell incarnated, the product of magic and faith, and a power beyond human understanding. She was the daughter of Absence and Wrath and Sarai, the many-named gods of the south, the Creator, the one responsible for life and all those who claimed it. "You shall be Lisbeth Lorne," a voice said. It wasn't a shout, but a whisper, nearly lost on the wind.
"Lisbeth Lorne," the girl tried.
She laughed at the way it sounded on her tongue. She laughed at the coolness of the snow settling on her face and hands. She laughed at how the fabric of her pale blue dress felt against her smooth skin. She laughed because she was, inexplicably, alive. Unlike the other humans that walked the face of the planet, she remembered the time before, a time when she was naught but a soul, a ribbon of light, free from the bounds of gravity and human nature, free from deception and violence and disappointment and foolish decisions. In those days, those eternities, she sang with the stars, laughed with the sun, slept with the moons. She was free. And yet now, trapped in this body, held fast to the ground, there was something liberating, astonishingly exciting. A giddy feeling in her lungs and chest, the simultaneous cold of snow against the warmth of the blood running through her veins. "I am alive." The truth of the thought echoed through her, and she took off, stumbling over the drifts at first, her new knees knocking together, her new arms awkward at her sides. As the wind splashed against her smile, she fell less and less as she learned, as she found her balance. Instinctively, she knew she saw the world differently than others. Some would call her blind, but that wasn't exactly true. She might not be able to see the outward physical nature of her surroundings, but what she saw held far more truth. For she saw the soul of every living thing, pulsing, alive. The truth behind a wall of lies. A single grain of sand amongst billions. She relished the joy of dancing across the soul of the world, feeling it breathe beneath her feet. Hours later, the night began to fall away, her star friends fading one by one, and she stopped, tumbling to the snow, breathing ghosts into the lightning sky. A wolf howled, then another. She sat up, looking around. They weren't wolves, for they didn't have the cool blue souls of wolves, ever stalwart, but something else, something larger. Their inner beings, red slashes of lightning, hungry, ever hungry. There were 10, 20, 100, a sea of predators racing over the snowy hills, cresting one and descending another, starting up the final slope to where Lisbeth sat, catching her breath. Riding each beast were other souls, a combination of light and dark, bold and fearless and intense. They were violent shadows that had tasted blood. Something pulsed through her. Not fear, exactly. More like curiosity. The first of them reached the hill's apex, skidding to a halt. Though blind in the typical sense, she sensed the weapons. Spears raised, shoved forward, their blades surrounding her.
"Us nom nath Kalia," one of them said,
a grunt that seemed to come from the deepest part of his throat.
"You have broken the pact," Lisbeth understood.
"Is nom Kla," she spoke,
the rough words hurting her throat. "I have just arrived." The one who spoke, perhaps the leader, cocked his head to the side, his soul displaying the grey tide of confusion.
"Us gurs homshuf. Cut. You speak Ghazi. How?"
"I don't know," Lisbeth said, instinctively reverting back to the language that felt more comfortable.
"Filth language," the creature said. "Now you must die."
He raised his spear over his head just as the sun appeared, orange rays reflecting tongues of flame across the blade. This Lisbeth could see, though it was naught but flashes of light on the edge of her vision. Lisbeth closed her eyes. She wasn't ready to die. She had only just arrived. Bright blue light burst from her forehead, piercing the vision of the multitude gathered before her, both riders and beasts. The Ghazi cried out, their voices raised together, their weapons dropped as they tried to cover their eyes. In that moment, she revealed their souls at all their extremes, the darkness, the lightness, the pain, the betrayal, the fear, the joy. The light died away, leaving only the mark on Lisbeth's head, a single blue eye. The Ghazi warriors crashed from their mounts, screaming, scrubbing at their ears, at their eyes, at their heads. The beasts fled, abandoning their masters, knocking into each other in their haste to escape. Rivulets of blood streamed from noses and ears, streaking the snow. Even once it was over, the fallen warriors continued to shake, racked with shivers, though they were not cold. Lisbeth opened her eyes. Her other eye, marked on her forehead, vanished, leaving her skin as pristine as freshly fallen snow. She saw what she had done. Hundreds of souls cracked, racked with pain, placed her face in her hands, and wept. 2. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anis Garrick. The knight was a snow-haired queen wearing a crown of stars. The queen's eyes were the moons, one green, half open, and the other red, just a sliver peeking out from behind a dark eyelid. Anis sighed, wishing that being a real queen was as magical as the false one in the sky. Instead, it was full of impossible decisions, unbearable sacrifices, and a lifetime's worth of heartache. Frozen Lake stretched out in front of her, disappearing on the horizon, reflecting moon and starlight. "What secrets do you hold?" Anis wondered to the knight. The urge to relinquish the crown back to her younger brother Archer and depart Castle Hill to find Taryn still arose from time to time, but she tamped it down. That was something the old Anis would do. The new Anis would fight for her people, her kingdom. The new Anis wasn't selfish. "Then why do I have to keep telling myself?" She turned away from the night, shivering despite the warm blanket wrapped around her shoulders. The temperature had dropped the last few days, ever since that night when Archer finally opened his eyes. With his awakening, it seemed, winter had awakened as well. Anis slipped back inside, closing the door to her balcony behind her. Warmth from the hearth instantly unfroze her bones, causing her skin to tingle. Archer was sitting up in bed, staring at her. She couldn't help it, she flinched. Though, for the last 3 days, her brother had been waking up more and more, and for longer periods of time, it was still a shock whenever he did. It was like she'd grown so accustomed to his unconsciousness that him sleeping seemed more natural than him being awake. "Does my face truly scare you, sister?" Arch said, smiling weakly. "I remember when his smile used to light up the entire kingdom," Anis thought. "Now it doesn't even light up his face." She'd released a breathy laugh, pulling her blanket tighter against her skin. "Only the awakeness of it." In truth, his face did scare her a little. His skin was far too pale, save for the dark half-moons under each eye. Worse, his cheeks were too skinny, the bones protruding at sharp angles. The sum of the changes was that he looked even more like their younger brother, Bane, than she'd like to admit. "Bane, the same brother who'd sent Archer into unconsciousness in the first place," she reminded herself, not losing the irony. He yawned. "Shall I go back to sleep?" "No," Anis said quickly. "Well, yes. That is, if you're tired, you should sleep." The healer was strict in her instructions. Archer should continue to sleep for long periods to allow his body to fully recover from the injuries suffered at Raider's Pass. "I'm tired, but I don't want to sleep ever again," Arch said. "I've got bed sores all over my body. My back, my legs, I'm sure your many admirers will rub a soothing balm on them for you," Anis cut in. "If you'd let me see them," Art said, and Anis was glad the quickness was returning to his mind. He'd always been one of the few in the castle who could rival the speed of her tongue. "It's for your own good. We don't want you to overexert yourself." Archer narrowed his eyes and chewed his lip, not looking convinced. His tone turned serious. "What I really want to know is, how did I get knocked out in Raider's Pass and wake up in Castle Hill?" Anis cringed. It was the question she was hoping he wouldn't ask for a good long while. She'd received a 3-day respite, as he'd been too weak to do more than slurp soup, sip water, and sleep. But now there was no dodging it. She decided to face it head on. "Well, there was a horse attached to a cart, and you were in the cart."
The horse pulled the cart, and here we are. I see you haven't lost your sense of humour, sister. It's a permanent attachment to my body, lest I fall into despair. Anise, Archer, I'm the king. I need to know what I missed. I'm ready to lead again, to rule. About that, she was saved by a knock on the door. You may enter, Arch said, sounding kinglier than he had since reawakening. Sir Metz entered, bowing at the waist. As usual, his silver armour was so well polished, Anise could see her wobbly reflection in it. Good evening, Sir Metz, Anise said. Allow me to formally introduce you to my brother, Archer. Archer, this knight was responsible for your protection many times while you slept. May I present Sir Christoph Metz?
Well met, sir, Archer said. Thank you for your service.
Now, what can we do for you?
Do for me? Metz asked. Nothing. I serve the kingdom.
Arch cocked his head to the side and glanced at Anise. She shook her head. She could explain the knight's eccentricities later.
What my brother meant was, why have you disturbed us so late?
That's a rude way of putting it, Arch muttered. Metz looked right at Anise when he said,
Apologies, Your Highness. May I have a word?
Frozen hell, Anise thought. Could he be any less subtle?
The answer, of course, was no.
Sir Metz was about as subtle as a stampeding mammoth in trying to enter a castle by a small door.
Of course, Arch said, sitting up straighter.
Anise saw a flash of pain cross his face, but then it was gone, hidden behind her brother's calm, confident expression.
Whatever you need to say, you can say in front of my sister.
Metz looked at Arch, then back at Anise.
Yes, Anise said, hoping to salvage the situation. Speak freely in front of both of us.
The knight raised an eyebrow, but then said,
A stream has been received from Darin. There is a storm gathering strength in the east. It looks to hit Castle Hill directly.
We have weathered many storms before, Arch said.
Why are you telling us this? Because we have delayed depart—
Thank you, sir, Anise said. That will be all.
The knight, seeming almost relieved, bowed again and departed the way he'd come, leaving them alone once more. Anise avoided Archer's stare as it bore into her from the side.
Why did he stop answering my question upon your command? He asked.
Anise said,
There is much I need to tell you.
Then tell me.
Just like ripping off a bandage. I had a name day, Archer. I'm 18 now.
And?
He still didn't get it. Still hadn't thought things through enough to understand.
I guess that's what happens when you're brought up assuming you will be king some day.
And you've been unconscious for more than a fortnight.
A fortnight? That long? I suspected, but I couldn't be certain.
I think I understand what you are saying.
You do? Anise was surprised at the lightness in his tone.
Of course, sister. My injury didn't dim my wits. You've been leading my soldiers, haven't you? Knights like Sir Metz have been obeying your commands while I slept. They're in the habit now, and we haven't formally returned the torch to its rightful holder.
Archer, tell me everything. The sooner the details are filled in, the sooner I can return to the throne and decide the next course of action.
It has already been decided. I will be going north into the hinterlands, along with Sir Metz, Sir Dietrich, Sir Jonas, and maybe some others. We're going to find the sleeping knight.
Arch frowned.
Enough, Japes. I'm no longer in the mood.
Anise sighed. She could understand why her brother would think it a joke. The 1,000 sleeping knights were said to have been the elite soldiers of the early northern kingdom, established shortly after the first Gaerics had splintered off from western rule, declaring their independence. Anise's ancestor, the fourth Gaeric ruler, King Brown Gaeric, was said to be a strange man, a superstitious recluse who dabbled in sorcery. After his elite squad was formed and trained, he'd supposedly found a way to grant them immortality, so they would always protect the North from invasion. However, what he didn't know was that once they were made immortal, they would leave him for the hinterlands. According to legend, they left because they were not truly needed, and only when they were called upon in the North's true time of need would they awake from their slumber. That was hundreds of years ago. Anise sighed again.
It was no jest.
His frown deepened.
The first thing I will do is revisit this decision. On whose authority was it reached?
On mine, Anise said, rising to her full height and jutting out her jaw.
Under Northern law, you have not yet reached the age of rule.
I have. I am the queen now.
3. The Northern Kingdom, east of Castle Hill. Taryn Shiri. Taryn, the man known by most as the Armored Knight, wished he wasn't so good at killing.
Maybe then I wouldn't have had to leave. Maybe then I could have been happy.
You look like you want to curl up in a ball and sleep, Fay said.
He glanced at her sharply, but the blacksmith who designed both his armor and weapon, the enormous spiked ball attached to a chain known as Morningstar, wasn't looking at him. Instead, she peered forward through the wall of lazy, fat snowflakes that obscured much of their vision. Taryn sighed. He should have kept his helmet on. He wasn't used to his emotions being so easily deciphered. But back at Castle Hill, he'd finally grown used to having it off, to people seeing the real him, the monster. Fay, much to his chagrin, was undaunted by his pale, translucent skin, nor the dark, protruding veins filled with blood as black as tar. When he'd removed his helmet, she'd given him the barest of glances before nodding like she'd suspected as much.
"Sleep does not come easily to me these days," Taryn admitted. "Because of her. Because of what I did to her."
Taryn, in his heart, knew Anise would be better off without him. Safer. She was strong, the strongest woman he'd ever met, stronger than him in a lot of ways, despite the supernatural blood running through his veins. Then again, if harm were to befall her when he could have protected her by staying, he would never forgive himself. He didn't know what he would do, the very idea sucking away his breath and spreading poison through his black veins. The memory of the last night they'd spent together felt like needles in his skull.
"Nor to me," Fay said, washing away his thoughts. Taryn immediately felt bad.
Since the moment they'd departed Castle Hill, he'd made this journey all about him. Well, about Anise, too, but mostly about him. About his self-loathing, his anger, his fear, his pain. But Fay, he knew, had demons too, else she wouldn't have left with him.
"Why can't you sleep?" he asked.
She stopped abruptly, clamping her mouth shut.
Taryn stopped, too, watching her, waiting patiently. Her boy-short hair was hidden beneath a woolen cap, her grey eyes darker than usual in the waning light. It was so quiet he could hear the soft rustle of snowflakes landing on the ground. It was the calm before a major storm, he suspected, an unintended metaphor for whatever was to come. Fay started walking again, silent. Taryn fell in beside her. He knew what it was like to have secrets. He wouldn't push her to reveal them. Though he'd intended to make this journey alone, slipping away from the castle surreptitiously, Fay had caught him on the way out. Without having to ask, she'd known exactly what he was doing.
"I'm going with you," she'd said, and he didn't have the energy to argue.
It was like the entirety of his reserves had been spent writing his goodbye note to Anise.
"Where are we going?" Fay asked now.
He was surprised she hadn't asked sooner, but for a while she seemed content with simply knowing they were going away.
"Darin,"
Taryn said. It was the first time he'd admitted it aloud. Fay frowned.
"Why? There's nothing there. Most of the soldiers were sent to Blackstone to die. It is an empty city. The Easterners will take it, perhaps sooner than anyone thinks. Long have they coveted the Castle of Blades."
Taryn didn't answer, focusing on one trudging step after another.
"You're going there to die," Fay said.
No,
Terin said quickly. Truthfully, when he'd first made the decision, he had wondered whether this was an attempt to kill himself. But no,
it's the only way I know how to protect her from afar, he explained.
She doesn't need protection.
I know, but that doesn't mean I can stop trying.
And there it was, the truth of the matter. So long as Anise had breath in her lungs and blood in her veins, he would never stop trying to protect her.
I can't be near her, but I can't be away from her either.
It was an irony he knew he might never make sense of. Thus they were headed to Darin, rather than simply disappearing from the face of the earth forever, like Terin had originally intended. You're a good man, Fay said.
Not good enough.
For what? For Anise? Did you think to ask her? Did you consider her feelings on the matter? Terin stopped, whirling around.
She doesn't know what's inside me. No one does. I'm dangerous. I hit her. In my bloodlust, the monster raging inside me, I couldn't recognize her. I hurt her. I could have. I might have. I couldn't control.
He sank to his knees, the heat cooling in his chest, the sting of tears pricking his eyes. Fay kneeled beside him, roped an arm around his shoulders and rested her cheek on his armored shoulder. And yet sometimes you're as dangerous as a puppy, she said. An exhausted laugh burst from Terin's lips.
A rabid puppy, perhaps.
Look, Anise isn't dead and neither are you. In this world, during this time of war, that's more fortune than most of us get. Don't give up on yourself when no one else has. With that said, she stood and walked away into the building storm. Her shadow trailed behind her, seeming to darken more with each step. 4. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Queen Rhea Loren, first of her name, felt as if she'd lived three lives. First, her childhood, a time that felt happy but wasn't. Back then, she'd thought she was strong, beautiful, untouchable, unbetrayable, rebellious but innocent. But she wasn't any of those things. She was young and naive. She'd fooled even herself. Second, the shortest of her three lives, passed in an instant, a time of pain and fear and brokenness and anger. And then, like a match struck in the dark, enlightenment, truth, transformation. In that second life, as short as it was, she'd grown up. She'd become strong, powerful. She'd killed without remorse. She'd tortured without guilt. Third was her current life. In this life, she was a woman, a queen, a unifier, a battlefield general, the commander of monsters, the defender of the West. She was strong, confident. And she was broken. So broken. None knew the truth about what she felt on the inside. None could see that weakness, or she feared they would smash her into a million pieces. None could see the child growing inside her. Without her mother, without her father, without grey, rutting Aris, she was alone. Even with the child in her belly, she was alone. At least I still have Ennis, she thought now. At least I saved him. That was good, right? That was merciful, wasn't it? Even she didn't know any more. Her childhood beliefs flipped upside down and drowned in the sparkling waters of the Bay of Bounty, pulled under by a thousand-tentacled monster known as Rathos. Ennis stood nearby now, just another one of her guardsmen. His disguise was effective. His blonde beard was thick, covering his Loren jawline and cheekbones. His hair had been shorn close to his scalp and was covered by a helmet. Two scars had been cut into each cheek. He did it himself. It was those scars people would see when they looked upon him, not the resemblance to her executed cousin, Ennis Loren. He was Ben Gentry now, a lifetime soldier who'd been promoted to Royal Guardsman after most of them had been killed by the King's Bane. None would suspect his true identity. She turned her thoughts away from Ennis, Bairn. Her people were waiting, whispering to each other, pointing at the three red-clad women standing in a line beside her. Rhea let the moment simmer just a little longer, and then said, "This is an auspicious occasion. Though we are saddened by the deaths of the three, we know they have gone to meet wrath in the seventh heaven. Our gods' furies shall receive the rewards they earned during their lives of righteousness and service." The growing child inside her kicked, and she almost cried out. "Soon," she thought, "soon I will tell them about you." At least the morning sickness had largely disappeared, thank Roth. She refocused on the heads nodding in the crowd. Her people believed her. They trusted her. The Savior of the West, some were beginning to call her. It was possible she'd had several of the Furies spread the nickname around the city. "But, alas, this is a time of threats and war, of sin and fear. A time of dark magic. The rumors many of you have heard are true. Our largest forest, the Tangle, burns. Some say it was caused by the evil power of the South, but I reject this. The largest fires are caused by a single spark, that is all. The fires will smoulder down to nothing, and we will survive, as we always have. We cannot dwell on rumours, or rumours of rumours. We cannot dwell on the deaths of the three. We must move on, and honour their sacrifice with our actions, with our devotion to Wrath. Thus, today we will anoint the new three, before Wrath and the people of the Holy City, not as replacements, but as sisters in righteousness." More heads nodding, more looks of awe, craned necks to stare up at the dais. Before today, this kind of ceremony had been conducted behind closed doors, but not any more. Rhea knew it was another opportunity to be seen, to gain favour amongst her people. "These three Furies have taken the oaths, and now need only a royal blessing, which I shall offer humbly before Wrath. Approach." The chosen three, women Rhea had hand-picked from the Furium, three warriors who had fought for her in the Bay of Bounty, kneeled before her, heads bowed. They all had red hair, though that was not the natural colour. All Furia used the same hair dye when they entered the Furium. They were all strong, their muscles taut under their red clothes. Anise touched the tops of their heads in succession and whispered the blessing. "You are the three, the chosen, Wrath's warriors in this land. You are one and the same. You will have God's strength in your bodies, and wisdom in your minds, and courage in your hearts. You shall not fear death. You shall serve Wrath for all your days. Amen." As each of the three's heads raised, the people said, "Amen." Rhea knew this solemn occasion was not the time for another war speech, and sometimes less was more. She turned on her heels and walked back into the castle, her guardsmen shadowing her footsteps. Somewhere off to the left she could feel Ennis's presence, feel his eyes burning into her. She refused to meet his gaze. She avoided the temptation to rest her hand on her swollen belly, hidden beneath the shapeless purity dress she wore. Earlier she'd sent a stream to Faria, a message for Gryon Ironclad. "I have your brother, Gareth, but I'm willing to trade him for another. Give me Bjorn Stonesledge, the Ironmarked, and you may have Gareth. If not, he dies." Rhea held her breath as she entered the royal stream, a narrow, slow-moving body of water that was fed by the Crimean Sea via an inlet on the western shores, near the Cryptlands. The stream passed via a hole in the castle wall and flowed all the way through the palace grounds. Along this portion of the stream, a thick grove of inkreeds grew, making it the perfect location for sending and receiving messages. Years earlier, the method of communication known as streaming had been discovered and was now used throughout most of the Four Kingdoms. Several of the stream workers straightened up when they saw her enter, looking nervous and uncomfortable. It was unusual for a lady or lord of the court to enter the stream, much less a queen. Most received their messages by royal couriers, who delivered scrolls all day long. Rhea breathed out, looking at the clear waters of the stream, which burbled along happily.
"What news from the east?" she asked, to no one in particular.
The nervous-looking stream workers glanced at each other. Finally, a woman, slender-looking, despite the thick purity frock she wore, stepped forward.
"We have received no response, Your Highness."
It took all of Rhea's efforts to hide her reaction. Anger and frustration burned beneath her neutral expression.
"Pity," she said. "Please keep me apprised of any news."
She thought of the burning tangle, how her scouts had said the flames were creeping from tree to tree, bush to bush, vine to vine, slowly consuming the forest, almost like the sands of an hourglass tumbling into the abyss.
"Of course, Your Highness."
She started to turn away to leave, but then the woman said,
"Incoming stream."
Slowly, Rhea twisted her head back to look. Sure enough, dark, inky symbols were forming on the surface of the clear water. Words. Sentences. Sent from somewhere. A sheet of parchment dipped into the water. A message written with ink from the reeds harvested in this exact location, disappearing only to reappear right here, right now, almost instantaneously. On another day, at another time, Rhea might have been amazed, but not today. She watched the slender stream worker wade into the creek, carrying a blank sheet of parchment, which she sank into the water over the still-forming words. The words clarified, soaking into the paper. With trembling hands, the woman lifted it, clambering back onto dry ground. Though she was buzzing with anticipation, Rhea pretended to wait patiently as the woman dabbed the wet sheet with a dry cloth.
"It's a message for you," the woman announced.
"From Grian Ironclad."
"Please," Rhea said, her voice even. "Bring it here."
Obediently, the woman handed her the flattened scroll. Rhea scanned it, her excitement building with each line.
"Queen Rhea Loren, first of your name. Although I am surprised to hear of Gareth's appearance in the West, perhaps I shouldn't be. After our defeat at Raider's Pass, his mind became addled. He is of no value to me, but he is my brother all the same. I will make this trade. Bring Gareth to the Bridge of Triumph 3 days hence. I will deliver Bjorn Stonesledge the Ironmarked. A man for a man, though I fear you shall receive the better end of the deal. Your eastern counterpart, King Grian Ironclad."
"Yes," Rhea said.
"Your Highness,"
the stream worker said. But Rhea wasn't listening, already turning away. For the first time in history, the West would have one of the Fate Marked. Rhea was going to celebrate. It was time to carve her new fury's faces.
5. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Gwendolyn Storm.
"I don't love him," Gwen thought.
The thought made her angry. She shoved to her feet, stalking in one direction, hitting a wall, turning, and pacing back the other way. In her tiny dungeon cell, she repeated this process again and again, her frustration mounting with each stride. She was an awe-hawk trapped in a cage, unable to spread its wings and fly.
"And I don't even love him,"
she thought again. Lying to herself should have gotten easier, but it hadn't.
"I am forged from awe, strong, unbroken, and to awe I shall return."
It was a mantra she'd recited for years, decades. It was truth, mixed with lies. She slammed her fist against the stone wall, which crumbled upon impact. Pain shot through her knuckles, into her hand, shivering up her forearm. She gritted her teeth, relishing the mind-numbing distraction. Her hero mark pulsed on her cheek.
"Fat lot of good you'll do me, stuck in here."
Within the bounds of Ironwood, she would have no trouble channeling the ore in the iron bars to escape her. But here, the ore was as distant to her as light from a night star. Footsteps in the corridor, an orange light flickering on the walls. Quickly, she sank back down in the shadows, cradling her bruised hand.
"Don't show them your strength. You are broken. You are weak. You are a prisoner, no threat to anyone."
"Eat,"
a garbled voice said, stopping in front of her cell.
"Eat,"
she translated. The dungeon master was a squat man with no ears. Each day he ambled along, past each cell, saying, "Et, et, et, et," like it was the only word he knew. Maybe it was. Now he held a rusty iron tray with a hard heel of bread and something mashed on a wooden plate. A small tin of brownish water completed the unappetizing fare.
"Can you push it inside?"
Gwen asked, forcing a breathless rasp into her voice. She reached out a hand, letting it falter in mid-air before dropping.
"Don't have the strength to get up."
Though the man was clearly deaf, kind of hard to hear with no ears, Gwen knew he was a master at reading lips. She'd seen him do it often enough, and he was looking at her now, soaking up every word. He laughed, the choking sound of a man expelling phlegm from his throat.
"Old tricks," he muttered. "Seen 'em all."
He left the tray on the ground just outside the cell, stood, and limped away. Gwen exploded to her feet, slamming against the bars, grabbing the tray, pulling it inside the cell, and throwing it against the wall. Hard bread and mush flew through the air. She sank back down, her chest heaving, the tray spinning circles before her, slowly coming to rest. She sat like that for a few moments before standing. First, she retrieved the bread, biting off hunks and trying not to chip a tooth as she chewed each piece 1,000 times, forcing it down her throat. Then she scraped as much of the mush as she could from the wall, sucking it from her fingers. Last, she found the tin cup, which was on its side. It only held a few drops of brackish water, but she dribbled them on her tongue. Her anger had faded. Her thoughts returned.
"I don't love him. I don't, I don't, I don't."
"Why not?"
"Because I'm not capable of love. A woman with no heart cannot love, cannot care."
This was the truth she'd held on to for the long years since her bondmate was taken from her too soon. The hardest part was the fact that even if Alistair hadn't been killed during the dragon massacre in Faerea, he would still be dead today, of old age or something else. From the beginning she was destined to outlive him, a truth that now seemed like a great injustice. Furthermore, even if she did love Roan Loren, but she didn't, she could never act on her feelings because she would most likely outlive him, too. She sighed.
"I'm a fool. I'm thinking of love and death and history, when I should be plotting how to escape this confounded dungeon."
Her mind ticked over this thought for a long while, her injured knuckles throbbing in accompaniment to her beating heart. An idea took shape, fuzzy around the edges at first, but then clarifying, striking her brain like a hard punch.
"I'm getting out of here," she thought, "and I'm taking Gareth with me."
6. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Gareth Ironclad.
"Go to hell," Gareth said.
Rhea raised her eyebrows.
"We call it the First Heaven, not hell." "You can go there, too."
Despite his bravado, Gareth's heart was pounding away in his chest, seeming to chip at the inside of his bones.
"I can't let this happen. I can't." "This is going to happen," Rhea said. "Your dear brother, Gryan, has agreed to trade for you. We ride out first thing tomorrow."
"I'll kill myself," Gareth said.
"You already tried that, remember?"
Rhea motioned to the thick planks hammered over the window he'd shattered. The same window he'd tried to leap from until... He swallowed thickly.
"He saved me. Roan saved me. How had he done that? Why had he done that? He said he loved me. He lied. He only said it to save me." Gareth was tired of thinking, tired of the questions with no answers. He'd vowed not to allow himself to be used against the East, and yet here he was, still alive, about to be ransomed.
"Anything else to say for yourself?"
Rhea said, filling the silence. Gareth shook his head.
What was there to say?
"Good. Now get some rest."
She left, leaving two guards behind. One of them was new, a fellow named Bairn Gentry. He seemed different than the other guards, in that he didn't yell or threaten so much. For that very reason, Gareth didn't trust him. The guards watched him like a hawk as he moved about the room, which was located high in a tower. A prison fit for a king. The space was large and fitted with a comfortable bed, a table and chair with several quills and scrolls of parchment for writing, a large map of the Four Kingdoms on one wall, and even a bookshelf with 16 books. Thus far, Gareth had built a tower out of the books, crumpled up all the sheets of parchment, and broken two of the quills in half. He had, however, slept in the bed, which was every bit as comfortable as it looked. He was frustrated, but not a fool. "I'm hungry," Gareth said.
"Then eat something," the mean-tempered guard snapped.
Gareth didn't know his name. He hadn't bothered to introduce himself like Bairn Gentry had. Gareth eyed the untouched tray of food that had been brought in earlier. The eggs were certainly cold, the toast dried out, and the apple, well, Gareth planned to explode it on the wall later for amusement. "I'd prefer a side of bacon, a jellied roll with a drizzle of honey, and a bowl of strawberries, not too ripe. Some white sugar sprinkled on top, if the royal kitchens have any." The guard glared at him. The edge of Bairn's lip, however, seemed to curl a little. Was that a smile? The unnamed guard said,
"Coming right up, Your Majesty,"
but didn't move from his position. "The service is rather slow here, isn't it?" Gareth quipped. Bairn finally spoke.
"Jarv, just put in the order, or he'll never shut up."
"So he does have a name," Gareth thought.
"Jarv?"
He snickered.
Jarv looked like he wanted to explode Gareth's head against the wall for amusement, but Gareth knew he wouldn't dare.
Rhea needed him fully intact so she could ransom him. Shaking his head, Jarv left. Gareth suspected he would get exactly what he ordered, though he wouldn't eat any of it. Jarv was certain to spit in it, and not just a little. Gareth said,
"Thank you, Bairn Gentry."
Bairn didn't respond, his lips pursed.
"You're welcome is the appropriate response," Gareth said.
Bairn opened his mouth, closed it, and then opened it again.
"I'm not who you think I am."
Gareth wasn't often surprised, but this time he was. He hid it behind another quip.
"And I am not truly Gareth Ironclad, but Montoya, Dragon Rider of Calypso."
He raised a finger in the air.
"I am Ennis Loren," Bairn said.
Gareth's hand fell back to his side.
"He's dead." All of Night's End had been talking about how Queen Rhea had executed her own cousin, personally.
"We faked it," Bairn said.
"Why?"
"She couldn't bring herself to kill me, and I couldn't allow myself to be banished. This was the only option in between."
"Why are you telling me this?"
"Because Rhea is making mistakes. She is too set on war. She's going to destroy the West."
"Sounds good to me," Gareth said, feigning a look of disinterest in the entire conversation. Truthfully, his mind was whirring through this new information, the true identity of the man standing before him. "She'll destroy the Four Kingdoms in the process, starting with the East."
Gareth sighed.
"What is your point, Ennis Loren? I can't control the fate of the kingdoms any more than you."
"Your friend, Rhone Loren, he wants peace, right?" Bairn asked. Hearing Rhone's name spoken so directly caused Gareth's stomach to squeeze into a knot.
"Yes, but he's also the fool who thinks lions can lay down with lambs without taking a bite or two."
"What if I told you they could?"
"I'd say you're madder than a blind man who wants to become an archer."
"Rhea cannot get her hands on Bjorn's stone sledge. It will only encourage her to march to war sooner."
"Then you'll have to convince my brother to refuse her ransom," Gareth said.
"What if I can do better?"
"I'm listening."
"I'll help you escape, if you promise to sign a treaty with the West."
Gareth scoffed. "Rhea will never agree to peace."
"Leave Rhea to me. As long as you are open to peace, I will help you."
7. The Hinterlands. Lisbeth Lorne. She hadn't killed the Ghazi riders, nor their wolfish steeds, though she knew she could have. But still, having probed into their minds, into their darkest dreams and fears,
having used that against them to subdue them. Lisbeth felt sick. In her mind's eyes, she'd seen great violence, a man killing another, stabbing him in the heart, and she'd seen great love, a child being born, cradled between its parents, who